In our study tonight, we're going to tie together chapter 13 and chapter 14 as we get on into the 14th chapter of the book of Revelation. It's crucial, I think, however, for us to tie these two chapters together. We note in the beginning of the 13th chapter, John says that he saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and he elaborates on that somewhat. And in our study, we noted that that represents the Roman Empire. Now, whether it represents a particular emperor or not is beside the point. I don't think that's the point that's being made. I think he's discussing the empire as this beast that came up out of the sea and given authority by the dragon in the latter part of verse 2. The significance of that is we know who the dragon is. And it seems that the empire has some authority that was given by the devil, who's identified as the dragon in the 12th chapter and in verse 9. We don't have to wonder about that. The text just tells us. But in regard to that, we noted that those who are worshipers of the beast wonder, saying, who is like, this is verse 4, who is like the beast and who is able to war with him? And there was given him a mouth speaking great things, blasphemies. And we compared this text and have extensively to the prophecy of Daniel. How that Daniel in chapter 7, verse 11, talked about this fourth beast. And if we follow the chronology of Daniel from Daniel chapter 2 on into Daniel chapter 7, we see that Daniel is talking about the empire of Rome. In the second chapter, it was during the days of these kings, the fourth empire that he identified, that the God of heaven would set up his kingdom, which would never be destroyed. Now, set in contrast to the temporal kingdoms that Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar about, they would end. And one of the things that we noted in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 11 is that fourth empire would be cast into the fire. It's more than just irony that when we get to the 19th chapter of the book of Revelation, those that worship the beast and the beast is cast into the lake of fire. I think that's significant to our understanding of the book. And as you notice in the 11th verse of the 13th chapter, John affirms, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns, like unto a lamb, and he spake as a dragon, and he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his sight. Now, we noted that this second beast that's identified here that came up out of the earth is identified as the false prophet or a false prophet in chapter 16, verse 13, and in 19, verse 20. Notice, if you will, as well, that he exercises all the authority of the first beast. So the first beast has given him authority, and the devil has given the first beast authority. So it would seem that the second beast that's described here would represent the false or pagan religions of the day that amounted to those who made it possible to worship the emperor, perhaps even to enforce emperor worship. I think our good friend and brother Jack Wright had it correct when he said that the kings of the area had the authority to enforce emperor worship in their various provinces. And so this is what we're looking at in the pagan idolatrous world that existed during the time in which John wrote. When we talk about this second beast, we notice that he is described as one that doeth great signs, that he should be given even to make fire to come down out of heaven upon the earth in the sight of men. Now, we've talked about false prophets in times gone by. We've talked about them with the people of Israel in the Old Testament. Jeremiah used some of the same kind of language to talk about the false prophets of his day. Isaiah did that, deceived the people by signs and great wonders, which they did. Now, be it understood, these were not miracles. But they, like magicians of Egypt, they practiced their sorcery and were able to trick the people into believing that they possessed some great power, much like Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8, who had deceived the people to cause them to believe that he was some kind of a great God. And that was what these people were doing, as we see in Revelation chapter 13. Another element that we did notice and talked about in that in verse 11 is that they say to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast who hath the stroke of the sword and live. That would be the Roman emperor, whoever that was. The empire itself represented in the emperor. And then in verse 15, we did note, and it was given unto him to give breath to it, even the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So whatever authority he had the authority to execute vengeance upon those who did not worship the empire or worship the emperor. And then we looked at verses 16, 17, and 18 and talked about what everybody's so interested in as it pertains to the mark of the beast. And there is a lot of speculation about this mark, whether it is a literal mark. And we discussed that somewhat in previous studies. We noted that during this time, it was not uncommon for folks to receive a tattoo or some kind of a brand or some kind of identifying tile that may have an image inscribed on it that would enable them with the ability to be able to buy and sell, as we see in verse 17. Now, in verse 17, we want to note that the writer not only talks about the ability to buy and sell, but he tells who would have the privilege to do that, even the those who hath the mark, even the name of the beast or the number of his name. And then in verse 18, we went over this last time, but it's crucial to tie together our thoughts into chapter 14. He says, here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now that's the reading of the American Standard translation. There's just been all kinds of endless speculations as to who that was. Some believe that there is the method of cryptology that was called gematria that was employed to identify this particular man and identifying a specific man. I'm just not convinced that the evidence supports that. I've read, I won't say all the commentators, but I've read a lot of them that take that position, and I've read a lot of them that take exception to that, even during the early part of the second century. So be that as it may, the point that we tried to make last time, and I think that's just crucial to this text, is to see how numbers were used. And if we come upon a plan to use the number 666 in some kind of a different way than numbers are used throughout the rest of the book, then it makes me suspect of that methodology of interpreting 666. Somehow that becomes an exact number and other numbers are used symbolically. That don't work for me. And to suggest that the idea of numbers ascribing to letters in a person's name, the idea of gematria, the thing that gives me a great deal of trouble regarding that idea is that this asks us to calculate a Hebrew transliteration, giving a different spelling of a Greek form of a Latin name. And that's just too much mental gymnastics for me to be convinced by that kind of evidence. Now, having said all of that, I don't believe that the thought ends at chapter 13. The thought carries into most of chapter 14. And I'll show you why as we proceed in our study of the 14th chapter. Now, having said that, I want to note that chapter divisions, as we've often said, occur in some of the most unfortunate places. And I think that's the case here because the thing that John saw, it hasn't ended. You'll note in chapter 13, verse 1, he said, I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. In verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. And then chapter 14 says, "And I saw, and behold, the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads." Now, I mentioned a moment ago that I don't have my mouse, and I'm going to have to do this the old-fashioned way, the hard way, as it were. And if you'll be patient with me, I think I can make this happen. And put that on the screen. And did I succeed, Richard? Thumbs up if I did. All right, great. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just a quick question before I know you're getting ready to launch into 14, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
But one of the questions that I mentioned to you this afternoon was in 13:15.
13:15. All right, got it.
I'm a little fuzzy on, I know you covered it before, but I don't have a firm grasp. And that verse 15, it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. I'm a little fuzzy on what exactly is the image.
It would be an image that a man made to represent the Roman emperor. And this beast in verse 11 that's being discussed that would give breath to the image, whoever that may be, I call it paganism, false prophet, he would appear to be able to make the image speak. And thus that would give the image his credentials, respectability, to authenticate whatever the image said. Now we know that images don't talk, and we can read that in the Old Testament in, what's the text? Isaiah, I've forgotten the chapter, where, the writer describes a man who built an axe, and, he went into the woods and he used the axe to cut down a tree. And then from the tree, he built a fire and warmed himself and cooked his food. And you're familiar with that. And I'll tell you in just a moment what passage that is in Isaiah. But, we noted the foolishness of that. That's Isaiah chapter 44, verses 9 through 20. Several verses there. We won't read it. But in the text of the Psalms, in Psalms chapter 115, you'll note that the writer, in describing an image, an idol, in verse 4, he says, "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. And they that make them shall be likened to them, and everyone that trusteth in them." Now, the psalmist tells us that that thing can't go anywhere, can't say anything, can't do anything. But wouldn't it be a marvel if some soothsayer or enchanter made it appear that it could? And so, I think that's what we see in Revelation 13:15.
That's right.
But specifically, we were talking about emperor worship. Did they have images? Did they have
like
statues?
Yes, yes, yes. They most definitely did, scattered throughout the empire.
So yeah. Not just a matter of offering incense to the concept of Caesar, but actually offering incense to a little idol.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now you've got it. Now paganism would allow that. Right. What's one more idol? But you see, the Christian couldn't do that. And so therein lies the problem. Now the deception of this second beast is seen in that he would do wonders and make it appear that the image could speak. And therefore authenticate whatever he represented as a false prophet that the image had said. Does that help a little bit? Okay. I think that that's a good point. And if you don't accept what the image says, then he had the authority to order you executed.
And what the image is saying is worship me.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah.
In essence.
In essence, yes. I think that's right.
Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome. Good question. Okay. Well, I'm going to go on then with the 14th chapter. I'm going to lay these notes aside. If you have any questions further, let me know and I'll bring them back over where I can see them. But I want to get chapter 14 here where I can take a gander at it. In chapter 14, keep in mind now, John didn't see just the sea beast or just the earth beast. The text tells us that by way of contrast now, he saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his name and the name of the Father written on their forehead. I don't think this is at all by accident that John introduces this like this. By the way, it'll be on our website. There's the some, at least, of the resources that we're going to be using. Let me jump ahead here because some of this I don't want to spend time on. This is a brief outline, by the way. Okay. There's where I want to be. There's the first verse. John, in seeing these beasts and seeing the authority of the first beast and the second beast, even to order that men be executed, then he saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him the 144,000, they had a mark too. And I think sometimes in our discussion of the mark of the beast, we forget all about the mark of the Lamb. We become so involved in the mark of the beast that we forget to read on and see there's another mark that's discussed in this context. In fact, it's contrasted with this context. So there's not only the on the table, either you worship the beast or you worship his image. You can worship God. You can do that as you worship the Lamb. And the 144,000 that are with him have his name and the name of his Father on their foreheads. Now, we've talked about this mark before, back over when we were in the seventh chapter, when we were talking about the four winds of the earth, and that these four winds represented judgment, but an angel forbid them to blow, as it were, forbid those judgments to come forth until the 144,000 were sealed. Now, I think the 144,000 of chapter 7 is the same 144,000 that we're looking at here in our text of Revelation chapter 14. That's not by accident. He's identifying the same body of people, those who stand with the Lamb, those who worship God. And when John saw these with his name and the name of his Father on their foreheads, the text then tells us that he heard a voice. Now, this Lamb, we don't have to spend a lot of time identifying who that is. The Lamb is the victorious Christ. We've already talked about that in chapter 5 at some length. And where is he standing? He's standing on Mount Zion. Now, some say, well, we're talking about the literal city of Jerusalem. Don't believe that, not for a moment, because the Hebrew writer makes the contrast in Hebrews chapter 12 concerning those Jews. You have not come to the physical city of Jerusalem, but you've come to Mount Zion. This is the heavenly Jerusalem. And to receive his name, that carries authority, receives power. Well, power to do what? To save your soul. You see, in Acts chapter 4 and in verse 12, there is no other name given among men wherein we must be saved except in his name. And we've quoted that for years, and see in Philippians chapter 2 the importance of his name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue should confess. These are familiar passages to us. And the idea of his Father's name being written on their foreheads is, I think, said very clearly in contrast to verse 16, of the mark on their right hand or upon their forehead, the mark of the beast on their right hand or upon their forehead. And so having said that, we see that we're not talking about a literal 144,000 to answer the Jehovah's Witnesses and the premillennialists. This seal is... I don't have that right. This seal is the same seal, but it's not a literal seal. Neither is it a literal seal in chapter 7. The four corners are not literally four corners and so forth, as you see in the discussion here of the first part of this chart. The idea is that of completeness. The 144,000 literally is 12 times 12 times 1,000. And is used in the book of Revelation in that way. And I think that's what we see here. Now, in chapter 14, verse 2, I tell you, this passage has been so perverted and misused, much like the rest of the book of Revelation. by those who just pick and choose a verse or two and then misapply it out of its context. And it's somewhat frustrating when you read these and study these in their context. In verse 2, John says that not only has he now in verse 1 seen the Lamb and the 144,000 that have the name of Christ and the name of the Father on their forehead, but it tells us he heard a voice. Now, don't miss that. What did John hear? He heard a voice. Now, the reason I want to emphasize that, as you see on the chart, I've just simply underlined the word as a number of times in this verse because it helps us to see that John heard a voice, and here is how it's described. It was as this. It was as many waters. It was as the voice of great thunder. It was the voice which I heard was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. How many of us have heard folks run to this passage to try to establish authority for instrumental music in worship and say, well, you know, John heard harpers harping in heaven? No, John didn't hear harpers harping in heaven. John heard a voice, and it was as the voice of harpers harping in heaven. And we might raise the question, did John hear many waters? No. He heard a voice, and it was as the roar of many waters. He heard a voice, and it was as the voice of great thunder. It was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And you'll notice that the source of this was in heaven. Again, that doesn't constitute what God will authorize for worship for us. He's not talking about instrumental music in our worship. John's vision was what he saw in heaven, and he didn't see or hear harpers harping. He heard a voice. Now, is that enough on that, or do we need to go a little further? It was as these things.
Ricky?
We've used these charts before. Yes, David?
You mean we can't have a live waterfall behind the podium as you preach?
No.
Oh, okay.
You can have a picture that's as a live waterfall. Okay? All right? So be that as it may.
When you think about it, you could justify that the same way they're trying to justify musical instruments.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But if you asked them, they probably would say, oh, no, you can't do that.
Well, be careful with an illustration. I learned that a long time ago. A friend of mine was trying to talk to a fellow that was a part of a very liberal institutional congregation. And he was trying to get him to see that fun and recreation, fun, food, and frolic is not a work of the church. He said, let's build a baptistry, and we'll make it a big one. He said, we'll make it about 25 yards wide and 100 yards long. We'll paint stripes down on the bottom of it just to mark it. And when we're not using it to baptize people, we'll put a springboard on one end, and we can use it for folks to swim in. Somebody said, well, that sounds like a swimming pool. And it does, doesn't it? Sounds like a swimming pool. No, he said, we're building a baptistry. We're not building a swimming pool. And the fellow he was trying to get this point across to, because he thought that the fellow would oppose the church building a big swimming pool. But no, he said, what's wrong with that? When we're not using it to baptize people, we can use it for a swimming pool. So be careful with illustrations. Sometimes they convince people to do the wrong thing. But what we want to note here is that John heard a voice, and it's described as these figures that you see on the board. Now, when you look at verse 3 of the text, what did the voice do? The voice was singing. Isn't that interesting? It says, and they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, and no man could learn the song save the 144,000, even they that have been purchased out of the earth. So now this tells us who the 144,000 is, much like what we saw back over in the 7th chapter. But look, if you will, that they were singing. They were singing a new song. Sound a lot like the song or the text of Revelation chapter 5, as we saw the throne room of God, and we saw the four living creatures and the 24 elders, and they're singing a new song. Same thing that's discussed here. No one could learn the song except the 144,000. And who was that? That was those who had been purchased with and received the blood of Christ. Now, we started out our study of this book with that point. And we noted it in Revelation chapter 1 and in verse 5, where the writer says, "And from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth, unto him that loveth us and loosed us from our sins by his blood." You see that same thing expressed in the 5th chapter with the singing of the new song unto the Lamb. And that's what you see here. Those who were purchased out of the earth. Any comment or question on that? I think that's very simple. Daphne?
Yeah, this 144,000, I know that there are certain groups, religious groups, that like to use this as a literal 144,000 representing the ones that are going to be saved at the end or something like that. But if you look at the way they're described, 12,000 each from the tribe of Judah. So if you're not the tribe of Judah, you're out of luck. Or the tribe of Israel. I'm sorry, all those tribes, the 12 tribes. So you're out of luck. And here it goes on further that saying they haven't defiled themselves with women. So it means they're all men. And so if you're a woman, you're also out of luck. And if you're a male that is not a male virgin, yeah. And I'm not going to say, you know, was there even 144,000 of those all ever? But, I'm not going to say that. But,
I always say that.
Yeah, but if you're not one of those groups, you're also out of luck. So,
well, that's right, and that's the point.
There's no point in making it be literal because it cannot be literal.
It cannot be literal, no.
Because it describes it.
Yes,
it does.
And
so if you're going to take it as literal, then you have to take the description as literal.
Exactly right.
And that's ridiculous.
You're exactly right. And I think you show the ridiculous nature of that kind of an argument. And that's what the next verse tells us. These are they that have not been defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they that follow the Lamb. Now that's the thing that we have underscored on the chart. And that's what we want to remember. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. Well, how were they purchased? They were purchased by the blood of Christ. And that's not a literal number. Now, I've talked, and perhaps some of you have too, with those who take this number as a literal number. And those who are part of that cult that identify the 144,000 as a literal number, they say, well, that's the elite part of even our organization. We're talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses, just so you know. That's the elite part of our organization. And generally, the folks that you talk to, they admit, I'm not a part of that 144,000. I won't be there. Why not? These were those who were purchased by the blood of the Lamb. And that's more than the literal number of 144,000. And for the reasons that you've cited. So, you stole my thunder again, Daphne. That's just exactly right.
It's how I roll.
I know. You're just a step ahead of me. That's all right. But you'll notice further in verse 5 of this text. Yes, I heard somebody. I can't see Terry. I don't even know Terry's on the board. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, by the way, you'll be happy to know that, I believe I do agree with a lot of what you've just said.
Well, good.
Yeah. You know, like we've always said, you and I've had these discussions for a lot of years.
Yes. Yes.
But I was wondering, regarding the 144,000, even though it's not a literal number, do you have a personal conviction on what the 144,000 could represent? And the reason I say that is because perhaps I'm getting a little ahead of class. But down in the, the 5th verse, perhaps, I kind of key in on the word first fruits.
Yes.
That the 144,000, whoever they represent, and I do have an idea about who they represent, are the first fruits of God. And Jesus.
Yes. I know that some take the position that this is identifying the redeemed of the nation of Israel, the Jews that were at the time of Jesus and shortly thereafter, that first obeyed the gospel following or during the time of Pentecost and shortly following, that these constitute the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb.
Actually, the position I take on this is just a little different. And that is that the 144,000 represent the saved of Israel, or the Jews who lived faithfully under the law of Moses, the ones who died prior to Christ dying on the cross, and then his blood reached back and covered their sins. I think I kind of hang my hat on the word first fruits.
Well, I would certainly think that those are included. I couldn't object to that. When you go back to the seventh chapter and began reading at verse 4, and I heard the number of them that were sealed, 144,000, sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel. And then when you bring that thought on, as Daphne has indicated, of course, there are some that are omitted in that list. But as you bring that thought past the list there to verse 9, after these things I saw and behold a great multitude which no man could number out of every nation of all tribes of peoples and tongues standing before the throne and before the Lamb, arrayed in white robes and palms in their hands. That would expand beyond simply those who were Jews who may have lived faithfully under the law of Moses. And it was certainly expand beyond the number of those who were in Jerusalem observing that feast day of Passover and Pentecost.
Gospel. You could see how the word first or first fruits would represent those Jews dying before Christ did, or I could see that in the position of those Jews who obeyed the gospel on the day of Pentecost, that in that sense, they were first.
Well, you don't have a problem.
As you were mentioning.
Yeah. You don't have a problem with that in light of what the Hebrew writer has to say about the blood of Christ in the ninth chapter and in verse 15.
Right.
For this cause, he is the mediator of a new covenant, that the death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant. That have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Now, when you talk about those who are redeemed by the blood of Christ in our specific text of Revelation chapter 14, you don't have a problem with reaching back beyond the cross. That doesn't give me any problem at all because of Hebrews chapter 9, verse 15.
Right.
That just doesn't bother me at all.
And clearly the 144,000 couldn't be literal, because
it would
seem that there were, in all probability, there were more than just 144,000 that whose sins were covered by the blood of Christ.
Oh yes, that goes all the way back. But now, Terry, in verse 4, in the identifying of this 144,000, as Daphne made this observation, they are they that were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they that have followed the Lamb, whithersoever he goeth. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. Now, as I said, I'd make concession for those who were faithful under the law of Moses and so forth in light of Hebrews 9, verse 15. What does give me, however, a little bit of problem is these are they that follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. I don't believe that now in the next expression we're considering another category of men. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. I think we're still talking about the same group of people. Those who are purchased out of the earth, the 144,000. Those who are pure, those who followed the Lamb, those who are purchased by the blood of the Lamb. And as the thought continues, as we have the passage on the board, verse 5, and in their mouth was found no guile. They are without blemish. The only way they could be that way is be forgiven.
Yeah, right. In other words, as you were really alluding to, that these, whoever they are, they're perfect.
Yes. Yes. And it's not because they've not committed any sin. It's because their sins are forgiven.
I think these are descriptions.
Yes.
these are descriptions of their, how can I put it, their perfection or their perfectness, their yeah. state of perfection.
Yeah, spiritually. Their spiritual exactly. condition. Yeah. I don't have any issue with that at all. I think that's on target. Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, we've talked about that verse, so let me proceed on. This 144,000 that have the names of the Father and the Son. And by the way, Terry, to your point, once again, this 144,000 as described, beginning to be described in verse 1, would have the name of the Lamb on their foreheads and the name of the Father on their right. foreheads. That might raise a question about whether we're talking about Old Testament Israel or not, to be specific. But nonetheless, I wouldn't have any problem including them because of Hebrews chapter 9, verse 15.
Actually, I think a side point on that really is that this discussion about their, you know, a mark in chapter 14, as you were the one who a few minutes ago used the word contrast. I think clearly shows that because, you know, a Christian, simply because they're a Christian did not have a physical mark on their body. And so you contrast that with the mark talked about in the 13th chapter. Well, I think it shows that the mark in the 13th chapter was really, you know, not a physical mark.
No, I don't believe it was at all.
I think the two in the 13th and the 14th chapters are set up to be, as you put it, it's a contrast, and therefore we're not talking about physical marks.
No. Oh, no, no. And this contrast, it just becomes more and more involved as we get into the 14th chapter, back to the 13th chapter. And I think that's why I've rather insisted that we read and study chapter 13 and 14 together and then compare that to right. Daniel chapter 7, because I think the point is essentially the same. Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 2 is emphasizing that the kingdom of Christ will stand forever. It will not be moved. The kingdoms of men will.
Well,
now, which one you want to place your confidence in?
Yeah, and we see the writer of Hebrews writing to those Christians that what had they received?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You've become part of a kingdom that cannot be shaken.
Shaken, right.
Yeah. So that's the legitimate point, essentially, I think, that's being made here. Of course, there are other passages in the New Testament that talk about following the Lamb as we look on the board for these. I'm not going to take the time to read those because they're familiar passages to most of you in our class tonight. But to follow the Lamb wheresoever he goes, these are the redeemed from among men. Now, we're familiar with Acts 20, verse 28, and again with 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18. You're not redeemed with corruptible things, silver or gold, but with precious blood as of a lamb. Now, would that reach back to include those Old Testament saints? I don't have an issue with that. But that's not who Peter's talking to. He's talking to those who are baptized into Christ. And I think that becomes evident a little bit later in the writing of 1 Peter. But be that as it may, see how much time I want to spend with this. Here's your point, Terry. The first fruits to God.
Right.
It's a figure that's used of harvest that's acceptable to God. Those who are separated for his use, they're free from deceit. They're without blemish, without spot. And we've discussed that extensively in lessons gone by from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 26 and 27, as there the writer is describing the church. Now, I don't know what else to call this chart. I've called it coming attractions because that's what some others have called it. But I think it's just kind of laying out what we're going to be studying as we get a little bit further along in this chapter of what God is going to do and how we can know that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And it's setting the stage. Terry, I like that word contrast because I think that's what 13 and 14 is doing. And we see that here in chapter 14 beginning in verse 6 through verse 20, which I think is quite an extensive comparison or contrast. Let me pause just here because I get to talking and Richard tells me I need to take a breath every once in a while. Any questions or comments just here? Okay. Well, as we look at the sixth verse then of the 14th chapter, he said, and I saw another angel. Now continue the line of things that John sees in these visions. Chapter 13, verse 1, he saw a beast coming out of the sea. Verse 11, he saw another beast coming out of the earth. Chapter 14, verse 1, he saw the Lamb on Mount Zion with 144,000, those who are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Now in verse 6, I saw another angel flying in mid heaven, having eternal good tidings to proclaim unto them that dwell on the earth, and unto every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a great voice, fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Now that's just an impressive passage of scripture. Now when he heard this voice, heard this or saw this angel and heard eternal good tidings proclaimed unto all that dwell on the earth, every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. What are the good tidings? We use that term good tidings quite a little bit, don't we? It becomes a descriptive term. We use the term gospel. When Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, what is that? That's good tidings, Romans 1, verse 16. And so we know that the term gospel literally means glad or good tidings. Now, what were the good tidings that would be preached unto every nation, tribe, tongue, and people? Well, it was the gospel. Well, what was good about that?
Forgiveness of sins.
Yes, forgiveness. Forgiveness of sins. So you give God glory and honor. You give him the privilege of being worshiped. Why? Because he's given you salvation. He's given you redemption, which is the subject of this text. He's purchased you with the blood of the Lamb. So you worship him. You fear him. You give him the glory. Now, we've talked about good news. I'll pass beyond that. Yes. Okay, thank you. Glendale, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to say anything. I just want to say gospel. So the good news is the good tidings, gospel of Christ.
That's what that is. Yes, sir. That's what that is. And I think when you see, Terry, the term contrast, I've used that over and over and done so deliberately because I think that's what's in these chapters. When you go back to the 13th chapter, you'll notice that the earth beast was given authority to command that those who would not worship the beast be killed. Isn't that interesting? You would be killed. And in order to buy and sell and engage in profitable business enterprise, you were given essentially permission, this mark, so to speak, that you might be able to do that. But what has God given you? He's given you forgiveness. He gave his son. He gives remission of sins. And so you can worship the beast over here and have life for maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 more years, as long as you live. But then what happens to you when you die? Well, you'll be tormented forever and ever. And we're going to look at that as this thought develops in this text. Or you can worship God and fear him. And then what do you have? You have eternal life. And that's the contrast that is, I think, very elaborately developed in these next few verses. The point being established here is that judgment, I don't think here he's talking about eternal judgment, but the hour for God's judgment is come. Judgment upon whom? According to Daniel 7, who was to be judged? Would it be at this point you would say Rome? because that's the context of Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, that fourth beast, what was going to happen to him? Verse 11. Daniel 7, verse 11. Somebody look at that right quick. What would happen to that fourth beast?
Be destroyed.
Be cast into the fire. He'd be destroyed. Now, I think that's crucial. We need to see that. What's God declaring here in the 14th chapter of Revelation? Time for my judgment has come. What judgment? The time when that fourth beast be cast into the fire. Now, here's where we are in that. Is that good news? If you were living during this time and the second beast, as it were, had the authority to command that you worship the first beast, and if you didn't, then you could be destroyed. Would it be any kind of a source of comfort to you to know that that first beast is going to be destroyed? That he'll be cast into the fire? I don't have to worship him. It might mean death now. But you see, the point being is I can have eternal life. The worst he can do to me is kill me. Now, what does that do for you if you've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb? If you're in this number of 144,000, not a literal number, but to know that God's children would not be trampled on forever. This would come to an end.
And those,
I'm sorry?
Gives you hope.
Gives you hope, yes. And it would also give you occasion to rejoice. It would help you to see that God's wrath is holy. His love is true. He's true to what he says, and there are consequences to unrighteousness. Now, Richard, how am I on time? Do I have time to even introduce this? Oh, okay. I took a breath.
I'm going to say something, maybe.
Okay, go ahead.
Backtrack to verse 1 where it talked about the Lamb and the Father's name written in their foreheads. That reminds me of 2 John 9 where when we, those who abide in the doctrine of Christ, have both the Father and the Son.
That's right. You have fellowship. And that's the idea, I think, that's presented here. It's not a literal writing of the Father's name or the Son's name, but you have fellowship. You're identified with them. You share or are partners with them. That's right. That's right. And I'm excited, as you can tell, about talking about Babylon. And what I would encourage you to do for now, in preparation for our next study, is to note that this is not the only passage in Revelation that talks about Babylon and the terminology that is used regarding Babylon is going to be discussed in greater detail in chapter 17 and 18. But I would encourage you to look at those chapters and go back into the Old Testament and read about Babylon. I think I have a chart somewhere that's got the passages I want you to read. You might jot them down. There it is. Isaiah 13, Isaiah 21, 47, 48, 50, and 51, especially Isaiah 13 and Jeremiah 50 and 51. Go back and see what's said in the Old Testament about Babylon. And then I think we'll have a greater appreciation of how Babylon is used in this text and see what's being identified by that terminology. Okay, so I'll stop sharing with that. And Richard, you won't have this one, I suppose, on our website. So if you missed these verses and you want to know what they are, send me an email or text or something, and I'll forward this to you. Okay. No. Oh, can't believe it. Well, I'll send you the latest, greatest update, and you just delete the one that you've got. Sorry about that. I've told Richard a number of times and others, I don't get finished. I just don't get finished working on these charts and studying this material. It's exciting to me, and I get to working on it, and I learn something. And I think, well, that needs to go in there. Learn something else, and that needs to go in there. But often it's after I've already sent the charts to Richard. So I apologize to you. I'll send this set of charts to you. Any questions or comments? Well, before we close, Randy Childs, go ahead.
I just a quick one about the marks, you know, not literal marks, the mark of the beast or the mark of the lamb, but in this life, those marks are abundantly obvious. If you belong to the lamb, you're not living a life of sin.
Yeah.
If you do, and if you belong to the beast or you belong to the dragon, it's obvious to everyone that you're living your life in an ungodly way. And, you know, I think about John 10, about, verse 4, when he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them and the sheep follow him because they know his voice.
Exactly.
We follow the lamb because we know his voice. The word of God is what we follow. And that is our mark. That's the mark that shows that we belong to the lamb, is that we follow the word.
That is right. Paul said, and I'm failing to recall the passage. Some of you may want to look it up. Richard, if you have PC Study Bible open, the Lord knows them that are his. And he has a way of identifying them. And it's not by a physical mark. It's either in the Thessalonians or in one of Paul's letters to Timothy. I think those in Thessalonica, but you might look that up for me. But the Lord knows them that are his, and he's placed his mark upon them. It's not a literal mark, but he takes note of them. And what is it about them that he takes note of? It's how they live their life.
And they who worship him.
And they who worship him, yeah. Okay, some of the rest of you that may know that passage offhand, I could look it up quickly, but you might help me out. Okay, well, I'll have to find it.
1 Timothy 2:19.
Thank you, that's it exactly. 1 Timothy 2:19. 1 Timothy 2:19. Thank you, Stephen. 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy?
2 Timothy.
2 Timothy 2:19. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. It's on the right place on the page now. I could not think of it. Thank you. It says, howbeit the firm foundation of God standeth, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let everyone that nameth the name of the Lord depart from unrighteousness. This seal that he's identifying here, not a literal seal, but it's identifying you by how you live. I think this term mark is often just simply misunderstood. We know that we are to mark those who do the things that are right, and that's in, well,
Romans 16.
Well, Romans 16 talks about those who are doing things that are wrong. But those who are doing the things that are right, it's in the third chapter of a particular book, Philippians, I believe it is. The third chapter of Philippians, verse 17. Thought I was never going to find that. Verse 17, it says, brethren, be ye imitators together of me, and mark them that so walk, even as you have us for an example. Well, is he saying to take a permanent marker and put an X on their head? No, but he is saying you take note of. Well, what is it that you take note of? How they live. Isn't that easy? You take note of how they live. Now, the passage, Glendale, that you were referring to in Romans 16, 17, you mark, and it's the same word here in Philippians chapter 3, verse 17. You take note of them that are causing divisions and occasions, causing occasions of division contrary to the doctrine which you've learned. You take note of them. Well, is it by putting a red X on their head? No. No, it's not a literal mark, but you take note of them by how they live. Well, I've talked enough and I've gone over as I did this morning. It must be this afternoon must be the weather. But be that as it may, we wouldn't close without extending an opportunity to obey the gospel. We invite you to do that. If you're a believer that Jesus is who he claimed to be, it's your desire to change the way you live, change your mind about your life, and strive to live in a way that's pleasing to him. The Bible calls that repentance, and it's motivated because the way you've been living is displeasing to God. That's called godly sorrow. And you can read in 2 Corinthians chapter 7 that that leads to repentance. And if you'd be willing to confess your faith, we'd be happy to baptize you into Christ. Good to see you, Daphne. Good to be with you. You take care. For those of you who may have obeyed the gospel and you're not living righteously, if we can help you by praying with you and for you, as you might correct those things, help you to do that, then that's what we want to do if you'll make that known to us.